Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 10th, 1998. In the Koinonia Fireside Room this morning is Fred Niedner. Today's session number is 98-10, and it's titled, Lord, Remember Us in Your Kingdom and Tune Our Hearts, Singing Our Lives. Let's listen in.
I don't know what kind of time we're on this morning. Evidently, the kiosk said 10 o'clock. Oh, Bible study. There is no such thing. Pardon me?
We figured it was a mistake.
It was. And it's now been crossed out, and somebody wrote 9 o'clock, which is correct. Okay. So we can begin. We're not. We don't have to sit here and wait till 10. We're going to start with an LBW song this morning. So I don't know if there really are enough, but I see a couple of them hiding down here.
Leaning over your shoulder.
Here's a whole bunch of them. LBW $4.99. My name is Fred Niedner. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana, and this is the last in the series of Bible studies I'm doing. The last of a two-week set of sessions on chapters in Practicing Our Faith, the theme book for this summer up here at Holden. And today's topic is Singing Our Lives. And I'll talk plenty about songs in the Bible and in just a moment, but I do need to take care of the hilarity quotient. Since this is the last in my sequence, I decided I could use yet another piece of this end of the world humor. And so I have a list of headlines here from various sources in the media. How would they report the end of the world? So USA Today, their headline would simply be, "We're dead." Headline of the Wall Street Journal would be, "Dow Jones plummets as world ends." National Enquirer, "OJ and Nicole together again." The Microsoft Systems Journal would have, "Apple loses market share." Sports Illustrated, "Game over." The Rolling Stone magazine would announce, "Grateful Dead reunion tour." Reader's Digest would just say, "Bye." Discover, "How will the extinction of all life as we know it affect the way we view the cosmos?" Inc. magazine, 10 ways you can profit from the apocalypse. Ladies Home Journal, "Lose 10 pounds by Judgment Day with our new Armageddon." And finally, America Online would send out a message that said, "System temporarily down. Try calling back in 15 minutes." No. And of course, up here at Holden, we would never know. In fact, the whole thing may be over, and no one's called us. They can't. That's right. That's not a bad thought, spending an eternity at Holden because you didn't know any better. Well, I'm going to start with an exercise this morning. This will be a little bit different sort of session than the previous ones, but I want to do something. So I'm going to sing a song in a moment, and if you know the song, please join in softly if you wish. If you really need to sing it loud, you can. It isn't that kind of song, though, but if you would just join in softly. But before we do it, we'll just be quiet for a moment. If you wish, you may close your eyes. Because I really want you, when we do get started, to just kind of be with this song and see what happens. And then I have some questions to ask you about your experience afterwards. But for a moment, let's just be quiet, and then I'll start singing, and join in if you know the song. Silent night, holy night, stay here in this room, or did you go someplace else? Share a little bit. What kind of places did you all go?
The forest.
You were out in the forest?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Stayed right here in this room.
Stayed in this room?
Mm-hmm. On Christmas Eve.
So you had a little time.
With the whole, what I smelled was
candle. I smelled baby powder. Cradling, that feeling, cradling our children, sleeping and having a peace. See that look of a baby sleeping.
Going back to the church I grew up in as a little kid.
I'll tell you, were a kid.
As a kid. So that was like yesterday. Going back to the home, front room, Christmas tree.
I was up in the night, up there with the stars in the night. I was with the night.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Sure. But not too many of you just stayed right here.
I stayed right here.
I stayed
here. Emptying myself and being for something to come. Mm-hmm. I couldn't smell anything because of the allergies. But
Well, songs do powerful things for us, and among other things, they transport us, or they certainly can transport us, out of the simple time and space that we most obviously inhabit, and they have the power to join us or to take us to the past. To place us with people who are no longer even around us in the most obvious simple time and space. I presume that some of you were literally, for a moment, inside yourself somewhere with a group of people that is precious to you that aren't here, or even walking this earth. Like we are at the moment. I asked you about smell because I've read about smell being the most powerful of all memory evoking senses, and I've never read enough to understand why that is. But I have a personal theory. This is not anything I've studied or researched or even read about, but I have a personal theory that whatever it is that singing does, it's something like that. Because of things about the way that music affects us. I mean, granted, we had words there. We were singing words, but it doesn't quite do the same thing to sit here and say, "Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright," and that doesn't transport you anywhere. But the music that goes with that does something like what things like smell can do and transport us. And so I'd like to look at some biblical songs and ponder some of the ways that those songs illustrate how communities have these multiform, multivalent experiences due to song that you don't have in other ways. And I'd like to begin by taking a quick look at a song that's in Exodus chapter 15, which is one of the Bible's oldest songs, or at least in the way the story reads, it's the first, at least as far as I can tell, the first community hymn that comes along in the story of the Bible. So Exodus 15 comes right after Moses and the Israelites have crossed the Red Sea, Reed Sea, on dry land. And there are many issues we could look at here, including the fact that you have the song that Moses and the Israelites sang to the Lord in chapter 15, verses 1 and following, and then when it's all over with, verse 20 says that the prophet Miriam, Aaron's sister, took a tambourine in her hand and went out, and you see the beginning of the same song. So maybe this was like some denominations where the men and women do things separately, and the men went off and sang it, and then the women went off and sang it. A lot of scholars today say that the Miriam song is actually the one that was in the text first, and the other one got added. But we're not going to get into all that. The question I want to think about is just thinking of this as a story now, not exactly how the story was shaped and got in the order it's in. But if you just take this as a story, do you suppose that when you come cruising out of the Red Sea with the Pharaoh's army chasing you, you just got suddenly a brand new hymn gets commissioned and you all sing it together? Or what's the deal here? You suppose they knew this song? How did they know this song? Were they maybe singing this song in the brickyards all the time? They've been practicing this song. This is slaves. The only thing they've known for centuries up to this moment, they're about a half inch or a few miles out of slavery. And the only singing they know is the singing they did in the brickyards as slaves. And just maybe, if not the text, certainly the melody is the one that they... This is a slave song. And they've been singing a long time about what it's going to be like when the Pharaoh is drowned. Right? I didn't think I should have got Narnia over here to sing this song that some of you, I'm sure, have been hearing around the village, where they're doing Pharaoh, Pharaoh. Oh, oh my God. So those dudes over there have been practicing this. You know, well, that's what was going on with the slaves. And so, in terms of the story, you know, I think we think about this as a song of deliverance from people who used their ancient songs all those years to remain a community and to keep intact and to survive what had been going on, what had been happening to them and what their fate had been as slaves for all those centuries. So this is something like the slave songs of our culture. Swing low, sweet chariot, and so forth. So some of the kinds of things we know that music does for people is exceedingly ancient. And here's an example of that kind of stuff, I think. The major collection of songs, of course, in the Bible is the book we call Psalms. And without doing a whole academic lecture on all the features of the Psalms, I thought we could look at a few things this morning. So would you flip into the book of Psalms? If you look right away in the first couple of Psalms, you can see some interesting things. The Bibles that are here on the shelf in this room, if you're using one of those, it doesn't have titles that give some of the forms that some Bibles offer, like some of the Psalms are considered calls to worship and others are laments and things like that. But they do have the notes for the texts that are actually in the scriptural text itself. So for example, under Psalm 3, do you have a note that reads a Psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom? So one of the only parts of the Bible where stuff is actually attributed to folks who are thought to have produced these things are the Psalms in the Psalm collection. And a lot of the Psalms are attributed to David. Whether he really wrote all these is a matter of some debate, but he was attributed with a great many. There are plenty of other people listed as authors, or whatever we would say. Asaph, there's a guy named Asaph who seems to have produced a bunch of them, and some of them are anonymous. So we get that kind of a note. Look at Psalm 4 at the top of that one. To the leader with stringed instruments, the Psalm of David. So there's a musical note. You do this one with strings. Psalm 5, to the leader for the flutes. Okay. And once in a while, Psalm 8, to the leader, according to the Gittith, the Psalm of David. That's the name of a melody. So just like, you know, if you still have your LBW, well, we got too many books around, you don't have that open anymore. But you know how at the bottom of the page it tells you author of text, author of tune, and on the other side, meter and tune name, right? Tunes have had names for many, many centuries. So some of these are tune names. Another famous psalm is Psalm 22. First line of which is, my God, why have you forsaken me? But notice there, to the leader, according to the Deer of the Dawn. There's a tune name. Deer of the Dawn sounds like an awfully sweet tune for a psalm that begins, my God, why have you forsaken me? But that's what you use. And this is a psalm of a very common type in the scriptures that calls God's attention. It's a psalm of lament. Calls God's attention to the terrible plight one is in, and then ultimately throws oneself upon God's mercy. These psalms can be pretty graphic in their description of what it is that God apparently isn't paying close enough attention to, and saying, God, now look at this. You really need to pay attention. If you don't, you know, and if you neglect this situation, the neighbors will talk, and you certainly don't want that. A lot of the psalms take that turn, and so forth. But this is one of those psalms of lament. Psalm 23, another famous psalm. Psalm of David, the Lord is my shepherd. I'm sure plenty of you have that memorized. And
but we don't usually sing it.
Well, we don't often sing. Well, there are plenty of hymn versions of this. LBW has two or three of them, in fact. And it's in the psalmody. It's in the lectionary as the Psalm of the Day for Good Shepherd Sunday, that fourth Sunday after Easter every year. And it's a wonderful psalm, beautiful poetry. Even if it weren't in a collection like this, it would still be among the more beautiful poems in the
King My Shepherd Is one. She's looking for one. The King of Love, My Shepherd Is. There's a bunch of them.
As long as you got that open, did you ever notice the sheepdogs at the end of that poem? Goodness and mercy. Surely goodness and mercy. The verb there actually in Hebrew is to pursue, not follow. Chase after. Surely goodness and mercy will chase after me, all, you know, nipping at your heels, keeping in the flock. Goodness over here, mercy over here.
Well, except that this is in the middle of this very beautiful poem that still waters, that when you come and help me, you've got to stick this in the face of my enemies to really slam dunk them with, right?
Right, yeah.
What is that doing in there?
Well, that's a good point. There are enemies all over the place in the Psalms, and we do sing about our enemies, and this is one of the tamer ones.
That's smash your baby.
That's why we.
That's right. So we'll look at a couple more pieces, and then we'll ask the question: what is this stuff doing in here? Before we do, Psalm 31 is another psalm that we've actually touched on in the earlier part of the sequence of studies that I've been doing. This is an evening psalm from very ancient times. This was a psalm used in evening, and folks I know who have traveled in Israel and attended services say that this is still used as an evening psalm over there. And verse 5 is the one that Jesus uses as an evening piece. Into your hands I commit my spirit. You have redeemed me, O Lord, faithful God. So, we'll talk a bit later about what it means for Jesus to have used psalms. Or the passion narratives describe Jesus as using psalms for his dying words. Psalm 109 is an interesting sort of psalm. Again, this is attributed to David. Do not be silent, O God of my praise, for wicked and deceitful mouths are opened against me, speaking against me with lying tongues. They beset me with words of hate, attack me without cause. In return for my love, they accuse me, even while I make prayer for them. So they reward me evil for good and hatred for my love. They say, appoint a wicked man against him. Let an accuser stand on his right. When he's tried, let him be found guilty. Let his prayer be counted as sin. And the punctuation suggests that this is merely a long rehearsal of what other people have been praying about him. But in the Hebrew, it's a little bit hard to tell whether, you know, who's praying what about whom. It almost sounds as though the psalmist is asking, and some of the older translations actually translate it that way, the psalmist is asking God to appoint a wicked man against the accusers. So this is a psalm of an accused man who's asking God to turn the tables on the accuser. And there's some really there's some really wicked stuff at the end of it that is very clearly what the psalmist is praying for God to do to the bad guys. Verse 26, help me, O God, save me according to your steadfast love. Let them know that this is your hand. Let them curse, but you will bless. Let my assailants be put to shame. May your servant be glad. May my accusers be clothed with dishonor. May they be wrapped in their own shame as in a mantle. So, in other words, take their words and turn them against them, O God. So, it's another version of what you just called our attention to. I had a friend in graduate school who used to put up a little sign next to his library carrel, which we couldn't protect our stuff. We didn't want to haul our stuff home every night, and it was a public area, so this fellow would just put up a little sign there next to his stuff that said, if anybody touches my stuff, I'll pray Psalm 109 against him. So we would go look at that, and it would say, oh, let their, may a creditor seize all that he has, may a stranger plunder the fruits of his toil, may his children be orphaned. Well, we didn't touch his stuff. It worked.
Fred, we don't do that so much in the Lutheran Church, do we? Praying for bad stuff to happen.
No, and
but that's a time-honored tradition.
Yeah. and this is where I'm headed. Bruce mentioned Psalm 137. You know, look at Psalm 137. This is a wonderful song. Another beautiful poem. A lament over the sad state of affairs of the exile. So this is a 6th century BC song. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and there we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our hearts, for there our captors asked us for songs, our tormentors asked for songs of mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither and my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth, and so forth. It's almost like a country song, you know? It's a song about being so sad you can't sing. I'm so sad I can't sing. But it's a beautiful song, except then the reason why this is not in the LBW, and you will never chant this as a part of a service out of that hymn book, is verse 7 and following. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem's fall, how they said, you know, they were the cheerleaders for the Babylonians, and they said, tear it down, way down. O daughter Babylon, you devastator, happy shall they be, pay you back for what you've done, happy shall they be, who smash your babies' heads on the rocks. So we don't sing that, and we don't even want to risk singing it, so it's not even in the LBW. Psalm 109 is not in the LBW. We don't want anybody praying that stuff out loud. Psalm 139 is in the LBW. This is a wonderful poem about, O Lord, you have searched me and known my downsitting and my uprising, as the King James used to say, or still does, but we don't read it that way anymore. This is in the lectionary, and it's in LBW, and we chant it, but it always ends at verse 18. And in my home church once, I was helping with the liturgy, and the pastor kept right on going beyond verse 18 because he wasn't paying attention, and suddenly, all by himself, he's singing, "Oh God, that you would kill the wicked." Unfortunately, he didn't keep going, or he'd have been singing, "Oh, I hate them with a perfect hatred. I loathe them who despise you, O Lord." So we try not to sing all the hating and loathing stuff, but it's there. You know, it's all over the place, as we see. What do we make of that? Well, you can do the LBW thing and just sort of cut it out for the most part and risk, you know, accidents of actually singing it. I don't know, I've gone through different attitudes personally about this. I've been embarrassed by it and all that kind of stuff, but my current thought follows the writing of a fellow named Eugene Peterson, who I know some of you know. I know some of you know his work. He's the person who translated the Bible translation called The Message, which is up here in the bookstore, a wonderful paraphrase sort of the New Testament. But he's got a book on the Psalms, which he says, this is Israel's way of being honest about what really is in their hearts and giving that stuff to God, as it were, by confessing the reality of the hatred that we have. And just like the confessing or giving to God the depths of the lament that we that is in our hearts. And then we don't have to act on it. We've given it away, and if God wants to act on this, fine, that's God's business, but we're not. We will give this hatred away to God. And we really are angry at those Edomites, you know, those cheerleaders for the Babylonians. But it's God's job, not ours, to to take vengeance. It's still a dangerous thing because it teaches, you teach children to sing about vengeance. You know, so you've also got to teach, you know, more than that, but I've got a couple comments here and there.
Just a little story though, and it triggered is that I have a child, like I say, who has been bullied by a girl. You know, it's the man's dilemma. Oh my gosh, what do I do with this woman who's hurting me? And we kept praying, and he kept praying. He would pray like that. The only prayer he could say was, God, get Cora. I kept thinking, what do I do with this? You know, I don't know what to do with this. I just made me think, well, maybe he was doing, I mean, came out of a babe's mouth.
Yeah.
He wasn't hitting her. He wasn't hurting her. He was trying to learn how to stand up to her and find his space. And mm-hmm. But in his prayers, it was get her. I just don't care. I don't like that.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, it fits somewhat to what Dawn is saying. I think that deletion is always both an easy and a temporary solution. It's easy because we don't have to deal with it. We think we're saving people from certain thoughts. It's what parents do to children sometimes when they take a fairy story that they think is just a little too violent, and so they cut the violence off and tell the story. But the kids already know that stuff. I mean, that's what Dawn is saying.
Yeah.
You cut violence off, you think you're keeping your kids from learning something or giving word to something, but they already know it. And most of the literature or the songs that come down through the ages pretty much identify human beings.
Right.
And instead of deleting it, which, you know, I know you don't do, but the hymn book does, and we sort of like to skip over things we don't like about the Old Testament, I think the confrontational look at it, and then to find where our position is with regard to it, because maybe what we don't say is we, oh God, hate our enemies, but what we do say is this element truly exists in us, and what do we do with it, and how do the Psalms direct us with it? Two quick thoughts. One, I have a friend who is working with Roseanne Barr. Mm-hmm. He was her producer. He's gone on since, and she despised him. In fact, he was the one who thought up that show that she did. She said she thought it up. He told me that when he went into work that whole first year, what he said over and over again in the car were the Psalms. It was a way, in fact, of placing what was great fear. She was a sort of bad person. She'd make you vulnerable and hurt you. She'd say, oh, Matt, and put her hand out. He put his hand out when he got there, and then she'd just whack it hard. And so he said the Psalms, and he found great satisfaction in that angry part. But it wasn't because he was ever going to do anything to her, but because he had a genuine feeling about this, and it gave it words and it gave it a place in the universe, apart from the office where they were working together. That's just a single example. But I, you know, generally, I just wish we wouldn't, in facing things that our present society thinks somehow or other is wrong, I wish we wouldn't cut it out, because the next society has come around and the new polarizing fools, you know what I'm saying?
Well, was that friend Jewish?
No. He's quasi-Christian, but he was Lutheran when he was young.
Yeah. I had a... Am I interrupting, or...?
I think I'm done.
Okay. Recently, I have a colleague that who's a doctor that was telling me about a situation. I'm a psychologist, he's a psychiatrist, and we had a patient in the Fairview Southdale Hospital in Minneapolis that he was telling me about a conversation he had with the insurance company or managed care utilization reviewer who had really messed over this patient, and I commented to him, my goodness, what if, I bet you this utilization reviewer was another doctor somewhere, you know, hundreds of miles away in some insurance building, I guess, and making these decisions about how much treatment could be allowed for this patient. And he had basically kicked a very sick patient out of the hospital, and my comment was, I wonder how he would feel if one of his loved ones or himself was treated in the way that he did that. And then my colleague, Dr. Locke, said, well, who's Jewish, said, when you say your prayers, you know, pray that that will happen to him someday. and I thought, you know, my comment earlier, you know, gee, in a Lutheran church or Methodist church, we don't do those kinds of things. I wonder if Jewish people do that, you know.
Well, the Psalms are part of our canon.
Well, sure they are. But, I mean, we kind of tone them down, I think, yeah. Some of this stuff, as you were saying, we don't put them in our hymnal and so on and so forth. And, it certainly is the quotation from Scripture, vengeance is mine and I will repay such reward. You know, I think it kind of says, you don't go get them yourself, but... leave it to me, and I'll take care of it, and or I'll decide whether vengeance is appropriate or not.
Sure.
Or that,
I would point out just momentarily that there's plenty within the Christian tradition per se which speaks like this too. It's not just what we inherited from Judaism. You know, the whole apocalyptic tradition, what the book of Revelation expects to happen to the Roman persecutors is pretty ugly. 2 Peter 2 says that whoever it is that author is angry with, those people are nothing more than wild animals, creatures of instinct born to be hunted down and killed. And these are other human beings, probably other Christians, that this author is so angry at that he's willing to say that about them. They aren't even human beings. You know, so the instinct to hate those who are against us is universal. And I do think it's appropriate to recognize that it's there. And the Christian goal is to lay that on Christ, and the rest of us learn to pray, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. But denying that we have those feelings isn't any way to deal with them. Thelma, you want to?
Yeah, what you said about laying this before God is very much where I am with the Psalms. In some of the Psalms, the people are powerless to carry these things out themselves, but implicitly, when they're praying, they are giving it to God, and they're being very honest. And just sitting here and hearing the conversation reminded me of a story that John Coughlin, who was an intercity pastor for many years, told me a while back when he was serving in South Philadelphia. One night, he was in the office of the church, and a group of young men from very young teens from the neighborhood came in, and he knew a couple of them, and a couple of them he didn't know, and they came in very angry, and they had knives and guns, and they pulled them out. They said, "We are going to go get this other group of people," and I don't remember the names, and he said, "What happened? Tell me about it." And they told him what had happened, and they were angry, and they were brandishing these weapons. And he said, "Why did you come here?" "Because we want you to know that we're going to go do this, and we're going to leave right now." And he said, "You came here because you're going to give these weapons to me. I want you to give me these weapons." And he talked them into giving him the weapons. He said, he knew he was taking a gamble, but he figured that they wouldn't have even come if they really had no doubt in their mind. They came because they needed to be talked out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what goes on with the Psalms. Or it could.
Yeah.
Anyone
having
prayed.
Yeah.
Just a thought, I'm not sure how you express this the way I want, but if you try to deny this, our violence, and our violent impulses, and cut that away and sanitize it somehow, aren't you in part saying God can't be with me in that? And that's precisely where God needs to be, in part.
Yeah.
And what kind of God is that can't handle this? And somehow in here it's tied up in the notion of we don't ferret out justice very well, and to be able to have a dialogue with God about that, and somehow let one to mete out justice, if there is such a thing in the kingdom. But also, you can't take in God's mercy. I think that's part of it. It's just so beyond what we can fathom sometimes that you want to put limits on that.
Thank you.
I guess there's something troubling about these songs or other prayers where we are asking God to do what we want to have done. You know, smite my enemies. Mm-hmm. There's only a short stretch from that to, you know, for find me a parking spot downtown where I go to work tomorrow. And my thinking is that what we're supposed to be doing is asking what God wants for us, not telling God what we want Him to do. Mm-hmm. And so that's a little bit troubling, but there's obviously a long history of that, certainly in the Old Testament and the New Testament, of us deigning to tell God what we want Him to do for us.
You know, I don't know, maybe this is kind of a distortion, but I come to think of these things as a form of confession. Not necessarily a confession of sin, maybe some of that, but confession of sadness and depression in some of the psalms and laments, and the confession of ugly, nasty, homicidal impulses or whatever, and that these psalms sort of model a way of praying and just sort of giving this stuff to the Lord and saying, you know, God, I want to kill him. That's the way I am. You know, not necessarily, I suppose in some ways, God, I want you to kill him. Not necessarily that I'm telling you to kill him, but that's what I really want. Sort of owning it. You know, owning the nasty stuff, the ugly stuff, the down and dirty sort of bad stuff. That's how I kind of come to see that in my life.
Yeah.
Is there also an element? I noticed you had a couple days ago Lewis Smead's book on Forgive and Forget, and I think one of the helpful points that he makes is that one of the first pieces in the process of forgiveness is really acknowledging the wound, the reality of that. And again, I'm not sure I can say this well, but I wonder, I know in my own struggling with forgiveness and anger and all that stuff, it seems like it's both important for me to be able to try to clearly name what it is that may actually be sinful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, back to that idea that, you know, the wrath of God, that God really hates sin and evil. But without just staying stuck in a blaming place. You know, I was noticing in Psalm 139 that it ends with, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my thoughts." I mean, you can either say that as, "Look at me, I'm blameless," or help me know what's
right.
Real
yeah.
In this.
Yeah, you're exactly right. This, you could read this as self-righteousness.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really perfect.
Yeah.
Sick 'em, God. Get those other guys.
Yeah.
You know, but we here in the perfect quadrant.
Right.
But you know, you could also see this as you suggest, much more helpfully as placing oneself under the very
right.
Same scrutiny
right.
And
acknowledging the limits of our
yeah.
Own ability to.
Willing to go under the same cauterizing gun that God's going to use on the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sounds like we could have had a whole long session on prayer. as a practice, and not just song prayers, but all kind of prayers and confessions and whatnot. Well, just a few more notes. We've only got a few minutes left, but as long as we're in this neighborhood, look at the little tiny Psalm 117 for a moment. Two verses. This is recognized by folks who study the forms of the various psalms as something known as a call to worship, like is used at the beginning of worship in many traditions even today. And by the way, to talk about these forms reminds me of a story about psalms that I wanted to remember to tell. This morning, one of the most prodigious Old Testament scholars of the 20th century is a fellow named Klaus Westermann. He's worked in Germany. He's often traveled in this country, and he's written many books on the Pentateuch. In his young years, when he was in his 20s, he was incarcerated in a concentration camp because he was a part of the group that was implicated in some plots against the Reich. And at the very beginning of his incarceration, when he realized what serious trouble he was in, he did have available to him a copy of the scriptures, which he didn't think he would be able to keep. And so for reasons of having prayers available to him, he memorized the Psalms as quickly as he could. He memorized the entire book of Psalms. And then it turned out during the course of his incarceration, when he was stripped of any other belongings, that he still had the Psalms in his head. And he studied the Psalms that way. And he wrote an entire book analyzing the various forms of the Psalms in his head during his imprisonment, so as to keep sane and to be thinking about things other than what he wanted to think about, the despair and all the other stuff. And when he got out of the concentration camp, then he wrote this formative work on the form criticism, it's called, of the Book of Psalms. And that's still the standard beginning point for work of that kind.
What was his name?
Klaus Westermann, Westermann. See, there are books by him up here, and he's written a ton of books on all sorts of Old Testament subjects. But there's quite a story about those songs. This little call to worship song opens a subject of other things that happen to songs in lots of cultures, including ours and this one. In the prophet Amos, if you want to, well, you don't need to save your place in the Psalms, I guess. If you haven't looked up Amos lately, it's in there with Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah. Amos chapter 4, verses 4 and 5, is written in the form of a call to worship. Only look what it says and imagine singing this. Come to Bethel and transgress, to Gilgal and multiply transgressions. This is a taunt. This is the prophet Amos writing a parody of a call to worship for a hypocritical community, and this is what they're really doing. You know, they're doing the rituals and they're singing the nice songs of Israel, and then they go off and do whatever they want. So he gives them a call to worship that would really be true to what their lives are about. You know, so this would be like us switching a few things around. Oh, come let us sing unto the Lord and blaspheme and, you know, go out and do all manner of adultery and licentiousness. Blah, 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 blah. So practically forever, people have been taking hymns and writing parodies of them for various purposes, in this case, in order to, you know, call attention to some hypocrisy. Amos is especially great at this. There are funeral dirges for the nation of Israel in here, and all sorts of things. He was a great parody artist. Back to the Psalms. Another feature, if you look at Psalms 120 and following, you find a whole bunch of Psalms with the title, A Song of Ascent. A Song of Ascent was a song that you used as you walked up to Jerusalem for one of the festivals, which all the people of Israel needed, or all the males anywhere, so three times a year, go up to Jerusalem for the three major festivals. And you traveled in communities. And since you didn't have a Walkman, or a car radio, or any of those other things, or you couldn't sit on a school bus and sing 99 bottles of beer on the wall, you sang Psalms of Ascent. And so when a bunch of people arrive in Jerusalem for Passover, with or without donkeys, singing songs, that was not all that unusual. That's what they did. They walked in groups all the way from Jericho and Galilee and every place else, and they sang these songs on the road. So these are road songs. That's what they are. Well, just a few minutes left. The opening of Luke's Gospel is written as an operetta, a six-scene operetta, each scene having its own song. Now, you know some of the songs because they are printed in the Bible as poetry, and we sing them on Wednesday night at Holden. They take the form of Marty Haugen Vespers, and we sing the Magnificat, and we sing the Benedictus, and we sing those songs. But every scene in that story has a song in it. They aren't all printed in verse, which they very well could be, but if you look, for example, at I'll just have to trust that you can find this for yourself sometime. In chapter 1, in the Annunciation to Zechariah, verses 14 to 17 are actually a song written in standard Hebrew parallelisms. You will have joy and gladness. Many will rejoice at his birth. He'll be great in the sight of the Lord. Never drink strong wine. Even before his birth, filled with the Holy Spirit, he'll turn many of the people to Israel, to the Lord their God. With the spirit and power of Elijah, he'll go before him to turn the hearts of parents to their children and disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous. Some of it is even poetry taken from the Old Testament. That's a song. So I think Luke 1 and 2 was actually constructed as what we would call today a Christmas pageant. You know, it's a birth narrative operetta with song. It was meant to be a sung deal. Okay? And of course, there's the bell, speaking of songs. But I do want to just say one final comment about this. I wanted to connect our singing of Silent Night and the places we went with this picture of Jesus dying in both Mark and Luke with a psalm on his lips, a different psalm in each case. You know, but just think of dying with Psalm 22 on your lips. I don't picture Jesus on the cross reciting Psalm 22, because they didn't recite psalms, they sang them. These were songs. I would not choose to die saying Silent Night, Holy Night. I would choose to sing it if I had any breath left in me at all. And what we learned by singing that song and thinking about that experience is that when we sing, we really truly are joined in a way to everybody who ever sang that song with us before, and by extension we are joined to everybody who ever sang that song or ever will sing that song. So if Jesus hung there praying Psalm 22, just think of the choir he was in. It's no wonder the temple of the curtain. I mean, the curtain of the temple tore in two. That's quite a group gathered to sing him over to the other side. So that's the power of songs. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.